I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 17th of November. It's All Things Political, which we always hear on Mondays at 1 o'clock. A lot to talk about. We'll be looking at the Republicans' overwhelming victory and how it happened. We'll look at the number of people who voted and find out what that means for future elections. We'll be looking at immigration reform. President Obama's executive action on immigration is coming probably this week. How will Republicans respond to the president's executive order? He will be giving the specifics of his executive action this week. We'll talk about what he is considering. And Charles Krauthammer has called the president's plans for immigration impeachable. It may be a pretty rocky lame duck session, and maybe rockier come January. We'll be looking at the climate change deal with China. We will talk about the Supreme Court deciding the future of the Affordable Care Act and a number of other issues as well. Our guest this hour is David Winston. David has been with us many times on this program. He's president of the Winston Group, a Washington strategic planning and survey research firm. He served as a strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership for the past 10 years, was director of planning for Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. He advises center-right political parties throughout Europe and is also an election analyst for CBS News. We'll be welcoming phone calls for David. The phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter. You can find us there at K Dunn Show. Hi, David. Thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be here. Good afternoon.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Let's talk before we get into the issues about the election and the overwhelming victory on the part of Republicans. To what do you attribute that, David?
Oh, I think there are a variety of things, but I think ultimately there were two things at play. The first one is the attitude about the direction of the country. And from the exit polls, 31% thought the country was heading in the right direction, 65% off on the wrong track. And what I've seen basically since the fall of 2008 when the financial crisis hit is this sort of very negative attitude about the direction of the country. So I think you're dealing with an electorate that is looking for results, looking for outcomes. And I think that's where the president and the Democrats ran into difficulty. I think at 4 years, there was a sense of potentially let's give them some more time. But I think at the six-year point, perhaps the best analogy is sort of like a football coach. You know, people may have liked him, may have thought some of the ideas were interesting in terms of what he was trying to do. But ultimately, there weren't enough wins on the board to keep him on as coach. And I think that's kind of where the electorate got to and basically said, let's give somebody else a chance. Now, having said that, the Republicans didn't get a mandate. They just simply were given the opportunity to govern because the country was frustrated with where things were.
And when you say the direction of the country, what does that actually mean? That people don't feel they have enough money in their pocketbooks? Or what is the direction of the country they're worried about?
In this particular case, it really is dealing with the economic issues. Jobs in the economy was yet again the number one issue by a significant margin. And it's a combination of things. It's cost of living. It's people who are working, but they're sort of underemployed. They're not in jobs that are giving them the resources that they need, nor what they're qualified for. You're having situations where lots of college students, for example, are graduating and they're not finding employment as well. So I think and you've had a large exodus in terms of people leaving the workforce. And so the combination of all those things, I think, finally just sort of mounted up, and ultimately the country decided it wanted to go a different direction. If I can give you one specific
number,
just to give you an example. In 2012, and this is from the exit polls, 45% of the country thought the economy was not so good. And you would have thought for Romney, that would have been a huge opportunity and for Republicans, but it wasn't. Actually, Democrats carried that group by 13 points. In 2014, 48% of the country thought the economy was not so good, but in that particular case, Republicans carried that group by 17. And so I think what you saw is basically the patience wore out and people voted to try something else.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I'd like for you to comment on, David, to me it seems to be an indication that people are really disengaged from the whole political process. When you only have, I find this disgusting, 36.3% of eligible voters went to the polls. That's abysmal.
Yeah, and we're not sure what the exact numbers are yet, and that's going to vary, but let me put some actual hard numbers in terms of what you're looking at. In a presidential election, last one was about 130 million people voted. Okay. In 2010, on an off-year election, and normally off-year elections tend to, non-presidential years, tend to drop. And to some degree, that's younger voters who haven't really developed the sort of habit of voting. And so eventually they'll get there, but they're just not there at 18 to 29. Anyway, it drops off to about 90 million people, which is obviously a pretty significant drop. In this election, right now the initial estimates were around 83 to 84 million, which is a pretty significant drop off. I think it'll move up a little bit higher than that as more ballots are counted. But going to your point, the bottom line is, there was a significant level of overall disengagement. I think part of that is the campaigns. When you're listening to campaigns and both campaigns are trying to describe not who'd be the best for a position, but who'd be the worst for a position, I don't think that really engages people particularly well.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the one thing that you saw from the exit polls were both parties had higher negatives than they had positives. And I think that's a reflection of that.
So the president is evidently within the next couple of days going to give some kind of executive action on immigration reform. He did a deal with China on climate change. I don't know what's going to happen with Keystone, but a vote could come as early as tomorrow. Some analysts are saying, well, the president decided he was criticized for not appealing to his base and for not seeming to be in the game. And so the results of this election to him were not that it was an overwhelming Republican victory, but that he needs to start doing something. So that's the way he's going to do something. Do you think that's a fair analysis?
And in terms of what I think his motivation is, yeah, I think that is. In terms of what's going to happen, is going to likely be pretty disastrous. You've already heard both Majority Leader-elect McConnell and Speaker Boehner basically say that if he does that, we'll seriously poison the well. I think that that's in fact the case. Having said that, I mean the American public and I think the president didn't see this, and I hope you're seeing it at least from Republicans in terms of the way they're talking at this point. At least the joint editorial that McConnell and Boehner did in the Wall Street Journal, and that is the public is looking for a reset. The public wants some points on the board, but they don't want them done where just one side does it. And they're looking for some way to begin to think through how do you develop consensus. And one of the problems the president ran into in terms of health care was it ended up being just strictly a Democratic plan on a huge issue. Now, if he takes another major issue of that scale and makes it just purely the implementation of one side and there's no consensus, I think he's really creating some governing problems for himself in terms of what are individuals' reactions going to be. And, you know, look, it's hard to get things through Congress. That's the way the Constitution was written, but that's what presidents have to do.
Mm-hmm. And yet we are reminded of this bipartisan commission looking at immigration reform last year, Republicans and Democrats at the table. The idea of immigration reform passed the Senate. It did not pass the House. How do you see a bipartisan effort, if there could be one, playing out on this issue and coming up with some kind of immigration reform, which the American public appears to want?
Yeah, well, and because the immigration system is broken. I mean, I think if there's one universal statement that everybody agrees to, is that it's broken, and somehow there needs to be some steps taken. And going back to that Senate bill, it actually had a lot of votes. It had 68 votes, so it was clearly more than just simply Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
But when it got to the House, and the understanding was the House was, not surprisingly, going to be more conservative in terms of its attitude about immigration. Part of the challenge that needed to occur here was an engagement in terms of trying to figure out where was the appropriate compromise between the House and Senate bill, or where the House was and what the Senate had just passed, and that was not an effective effort that was led by the president. And ultimately, you know, the problem with governing is you got to talk other people into doing things. And sometimes that takes some level of compromise to be able to get there.
Mm-hmm. I believe it was E.J. Dionne over the weekend said that the Republicans are about as divided when it comes to voter immigration policy as any political party is over any single issue. Would you say, David, that there is any kind of consensus among Republicans as to what should constitute immigration reform?
No, and I would actually EJ is correct in that. I mean, when you go back to 2005-06, when you had John McCain and George W. Bush on one side, and then you had a group of other folks on the other. I mean, the problem that's existed here is on the Republican side is there isn't a consensus in terms of what should happen, which obviously makes it a lot more difficult for Speaker Boehner then to sort of work through that when he's still trying to find a consensus within the party. But I think that that's where the opportunity is in terms of who can engage Republicans in such a way that you can begin to develop that consensus and at least a comfort level to move forward. And there are points of agreement. I mean, you know, everybody understands that we need a border system that works. We obviously need to address the fact that we've got people here who are contributing, that perhaps, you know, in terms of looking what their status is. But again, what hasn't occurred here is, you know, the president sitting everybody in a room and saying, okay, let's sit down and work through it. I mean, that's what Bill Clinton used to do with Newt. You know, get him over there and sit down and work through things. And that tended to work pretty well.
And what about a leader in the Republican Party? Because it is divided on this issue. Is it who is most persuasive? Is it somebody like Rubio? Is it somebody like Cruz? Who can get people together at the table on the Republican side?
Yeah, I think this is probably going to come back to the leadership. This is going to be McConnell and Boehner getting their members together and sitting down and saying, look, you know, we've now been handed this responsibility to govern. What are we going to do with this issue? Just, you know, punting it is not going to be an acceptable answer to the public. Because here's the other thing. Again, I go back to, you know, Republicans were given the opportunity to govern because there was a frustration that there weren't wins being put on the board. Well, if Republicans can't put any wins on the board, that could be a pretty short-term majority.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Supreme Court. I'm not sure how quickly this is going to happen. Obviously, the Affordable Care Act has remained controversial for a long time now. Do you have any idea if they'll be taking this up this week or next week? And could they indeed give a devastating challenge to this law?
Yeah, my understanding is that when people would sort of expect them to actually decide the case, it would come out sometime early summer of next year. So they'll hear the case sometime between now and then, and then do the decision. What's the technical argument that's in place is that the idea that you have to purchase, if you're going to get the sort of benefits from the government, or if you're going to get the benefit here in terms of being able to get help with your insurance, it has to be done through state exchanges. Well, there are a lot of states, about 35, that didn't do state exchanges. And so that has been coming to the federal government. And what's the question is the law was written specifically just for states. And so the federal government couldn't do that. And so therefore, if that didn't exist, then basically it causes the entire system to crash at that point because people couldn't possibly afford. So it's pretty critical, and I don't think people know. I mean, the question is, does one believe that it was the intent of Congress that state exchanges were the way things were going to be funded, or was it just simply that's what they said, but they were looking at something broader? So you're trying to get at intent, and we'll see what the court decides.
Yeah. Keystone Pipeline, a vote tomorrow?
That's the understanding. Not to be sort of crass here, but I mean, clearly Leader Reid is trying to hold on to Mary Landrieu in terms of the seat and sort of bring it up for a vote, although clearly the president has been pretty adamant in terms of his likelihood to veto that. I would have to say that if I were somebody like Mark Pryor at this point, you know, now Leader Reid brings it up as opposed to potentially prior to the election. There may be a couple of senators who would have preferred to have seen that happen earlier. I think there's a reasonable chance that it'll pass, but it'll get vetoed by the president.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think they're, well, maybe this isn't true, but Mary Landrieu is going to have a pretty hard time holding on to that seat, don't you think?
Yeah, I think clearly, particularly given what just happened in the election, the odds clearly favor the Republican. Again, when you take a look at other statewide offices, those have gone to Republicans as well. Having said that, it's a special, and more odd things than that have happened. But I think at this point, it's likely to go Republican.
Full set of phone lines coming in for you, David. We'll take our calls in a moment. David Winston is our guest for all things political, president of the Winston Group. It's a Washington, D.C. strategic planning and survey research firm. He's been an advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership for the past 10 years, was director of planning for Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, and he advises political parties throughout Europe and is an election analyst for CBS News. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. You can leave comments on our Facebook page as well, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today was inspired by Leonard Cohen deciding that he was going to start smoking cigarettes again at the age of 80. And our guest wrote a very interesting piece in the New York Times end of September saying, "I don't plan to celebrate my 80th birthday with a cigarette or a colonoscopy. I don't want my aging experience reduced to an online actuarial accounting exercise." He is professor of medicine, medical ethics, and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania, and it should be a fascinating conversation hour two. David Winston is with us now for all things political, and we start our calls with Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Republicans are pretty good at scaring people, and so they could use ISIS and the immigration issue and guns, of course, to frighten people. But one issue that the Democrats should have used to scare Republican men would be the environment issue. I remember riding through Burlington and seeing a sign that said "Sportsman for Walker." And it said help preserve Wisconsin's legacy. Well, you know, how do you preserve the legacy of sports or anything else, for that matter, if you have a situation where you have the candidate accepting money from people who want to cut corners and deregulate in terms of mining, thus allowing life-threatening, cancer-causing chemicals into the environment? And in my wife's Bible study, for example, 5 of the 9 women that are in that Bible study currently have breast cancer. So the cancer is an ongoing threat in the society, and it's enhanced when people deregulate and allow cancer-causing chemicals into the environment.
All right. David.
Well, I mean, one of the and this will sort of relate back to what the president just did in China, in terms of dealing with climate change and the environment. I mean, the bottom line is when you take a look in terms of most surveys, given the issue mix, right now that's not as high a priority as just jobs and the economy. That doesn't mean the issue is not important. It is important, and when you ask people on like a scale of 1 to 100 how important it is, I mean it's well up there. But when you're pitting it against other issues, it's just that jobs and the economy are so overwhelming, and as a result, what you're seeing is, so what are those things that can occur? And obviously, for example, Keystone Pipeline is an example that where there's a lot of support for it because there's a jobs component and there's a potential positive energy impact. But let me go back to one other thing that he was sort of describing, and actually, Kathleen, you had sort of brought up the one sort of baffling mistake I thought Democrats made was this whole idea of here are this big national issue in terms of jobs and the economy, but in terms of all these races, because of their concern about the status of the president, they decided to make everything local. And that was going to be the focus, and rather than as a national party engaging in the, you know, what direction the economy should go. And I think what ultimately happened there is here's a national party not engaging the electorate in terms of these national issues, and I think that that hurt. I don't think they necessarily would have won those arguments, but by not engaging in them at all, certainly did not help.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that's what Republicans did in 2006. They tried to localize the election because they were concerned about what George W. Bush was going to do, and to a large degree didn't engage in the debate and had an equal level of success that Democrats had this year.
Jim mentioned in passing Governor Scott Walker, elected for the third time. What is his natural future? Is it bright?
I don't think that's certainly better than it was prior to the recall. But I think he has some opportunities, but I think a lot of it depends on how he now manages over the next year or so in terms of what does he do, to move things forward. I'm going to tell you, one of the things that's going to be interesting, again, where I think this electorate is the electorate wants to see who can put, for lack of a better phrase, you know, wins on the board. They want to see who in fact, can move things forward. Having a engaging personality or being charismatic, interesting at one level, but ultimately in the end, people want to see points on the board. And so I think that's the challenge to Governor Walker. I think it's the challenge to Governor Kasich. I think it's the challenge to, name the potential Republican candidate. Having said that, he's in a state that Republicans don't normally get at a presidential level. So that's certainly a plus for him.
Mm-hmm. David, do you have somebody you're willing to work for now?
I have to say, and looking at the potential field, there are just a lot of very good candidates on the Republican side. That's obviously a biased perspective. I'm sure there are probably some listeners who are probably cringing, going, "Oh, I don't like any of them." But from my perspective, which obviously the Republican side,
right.
I think there are a variety of folks, and I think what's going to occur here is it's not necessarily going to be personality, but who comes up with the sort of most engaging, interesting idea that people think can work, and do they actually believe the person could get that implemented? I think that's going to be the basis. And I think we've got a variety of folks, whether, again, you know, Walker, Kasich, Christie, Bush, Jeb Bush, to Rob Portman, Rubio, Paul Ryan. I mean, they're just a variety of people who I think actually represent a pretty interesting field that is pretty quality level.
800-486-8655 is our number. And Jim, thanks for the call. And we go next to Ray in Milwaukee. Hello, Ray.
Hi. I don't know if anybody caught this week with Bill Moyers during this last week, but they had two guests on there, a lady and a man. Don't remember their names, but they gave an excellent, excellent inside look at what was really happening with the Democrats. And part of the reason they lost was their ties to big money and how money kind of was like leading the stagecoach there. They had the bit in their mouth, and all they could do was follow the direction their donors were pointing them. And it's fascinating. You can check it out online, I think. But if you get a chance, you want to see that. And I want to talk about our debates across the country. Am I the only one who was outraged by the fact that they only allow the Democrats and Republicans into these debates when often there's three, four, five different, maybe different other candidates, and they have to cross some ridiculous threshold to have their views? You know, if you're running for office, if you've taken that effort, you should have the right to be on stage, unless it's some outrageous number. Let's say 100 candidates ran and you really couldn't have a debate then. But the way it's been shut out by the Democrats and Republicans just makes me want to pull what's left of my hair out.
David.
Well, I don't do that. Being someone who's follically challenged, I encourage you not to do that. Let me talk about big money first, and then I'll go to the multiple debate. I would urge people to realize that money is a resource, not an outcome. And what I mean by that is ultimately this still does come down to ideas, what candidates say. And hearing an ad for the 94th time, the same ad the 94th time versus the 73rd time, really isn't going to move people. And I think one of the things we saw for a while there was that everybody was running all this television, and truth be told, it wasn't moving a lot of people because what was being said wasn't addressing concerns that people had, and so they didn't have any information to change their views. Ultimately, it still comes down to content. You know, when you get into very tight races, then that margin can be different. But I encourage people that look at the ideas and what people are saying. In terms of multiple candidates in a race, again, Ray sort of identified the dynamic of where you draw the line. He said 100 candidates, so that's his threshold in terms of where you cut it off. I think that sometimes there's not a willingness to let other candidates get on stage in terms of who may have some standing. And I think obviously you'll see the media look at that a little bit more closely. But ultimately you have to make a call in terms of if someone is only getting 1% of the vote and they've had a chance to sort of be seen a bit, that means, you know, but what do you do in terms of trying to make sure that people can hear what then the two primary candidates have to say. And that's just a editorial call on part of whoever handles those debates.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you said about money is interesting, David, because you're a strategic planner and you do survey research here. Are you saying that there are a whole lot of people spending a whole lot of money, I mean, huge amounts of money on these elections? You're saying that doesn't really matter?
No, I don't think because again, if what you're saying is not anything that people are going to listen to, just saying it louder and longer isn't going to make much of a difference. And so I think, you know, having the opportunity using money to be able to put out in a very public way what you want people to hear is an opportunity. Just because you have that opportunity doesn't mean it turns into anything that'll work. That is, you know, you have to be talking about issues that matter to people. And if you're not doing that, you know, you can be saying as much as you want, but people aren't going to pay attention. So it's a combination. It's a combination of both. I'm not saying that money is not important, but what I am saying is sometimes, like I said, if you're saying the same thing the 94th time, you know, what somebody after they hearing it 73 times
right.
wasn't enough. They needed 94. Yeah,
right. Yeah, I agree. And you're seeing the same commercial every 2 minutes. It's incredible. Willem in Colfax. Hi.
Hi. I guess what troubles me about the Republican leadership and the direction that they're taking us is that it's such short-term thinking, and I wish we had some leaders who would had some foresight, especially when it comes to, like, energy policy. We're spending, you know, 10, 20 times more subsidizing oil and gas than we are alternative energies, and in our state that means we're losing tens of thousands of acres to frac sand mining and other things like that. And our So while they talk about concern for future generations, their policies are not going to lead us to a cleaner future. I mean, there's 192 science associations around the world. I mean, science foundations from different national science foundations that agree that climate change is happening. But in this country, because fueled by the same people that, you know, we all remember what happened with the tobacco industry. They lied in front of Congress, and the oil and gas industry has way more money. And I guess I would like to, I came across a quote by Mark Twain I think that is really relevant to this time. He said, "Sometimes I wonder whether the world is being run by smart people who are putting us on or by imbeciles who really mean it."
David.
You know, you can never go wrong with a Mark Twain quote, okay? I'm going to have to remember that one. That was quite good. Anyway, here's a couple things in terms of energy. First off, where the public is at, and this is obviously a challenge for people who are focused specifically on climate change as the driving factor for energy policy. Where the public is at this point, and this goes back to what we were talking about, cost of living and just wages and how people are managing their day-to-day lives, what they're really looking for is, and you've heard both Speaker Boehner and the President say this, sort of the all-the-above energy strategy. And what that means is maximize everything. And so they, yes, they want to see alternative energy, but they also want to see more natural gas and oil exploration, because what they're looking for is something that is going to help drive down prices and make sure that they can afford their energy costs. And so, you know, you have to, again, like I said, some individuals, I mean, the complete focus is climate change in terms of energy policy. But for other people, it's the economy and what their family can afford, and that's their driving concern.
Let's talk about Ferguson for a moment and ask the question. Lots of people believe that the police officer, the white police officer who shot Michael Brown, will not be indicted, and there are demonstrations going on in Ferguson. I would imagine there are a lot of people on edge today and have been concerning how everybody will respond, not only in Ferguson, but in other parts of the country, to the grand jury decision. Do you have a reaction to that, David?
Well, again, not knowing the facts of the case, okay, and so I don't want to go in and sort of assert innocence or guilt or whatever, but clearly it's an explosive situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just no question in terms of that. And I think that unfortunately does not speak well in terms of where race relations are in terms of the country at this point. There's obviously a huge level of distrust that is prevalent. And I think what it reflects is there's quite a bit of work to be done here to sort of get things back on the right track in terms of race relations. And I think Ferguson has been sort of a focal point or a catalyst in terms of showing those difficulties. Having said that, again, I have, you know, not being privy to the testimony, I have no idea whether he's guilty or not. But like I said, it's still going to be an explosive moment either way.
Mm-hmm. In terms of issues like racial profiling, police conduct, those have been brought front and center. Are there things that politicians in Washington can do to seriously address those issues?
Well, I think that again, it's this whole element in terms of quality of life, opportunity, so that there's a general sense of better opportunity, and there, not sense of better opportunity, actual better opportunities that just create a more positive environment. And again, one, you know, in this particular situation, you have some unique circumstances. But I think the broader element here is what are the opportunities in the overall sense of how things are moving forward in terms of race relations, but also specifically in terms of ensuring that opportunities are there for everybody. And by the way, I would suggest that would go back to a critical issue that actually saw a sort of increase in terms of concern in a lot of national polls, and that's education. And I think you'll see a lot of discussion about how to improve the education system over the next couple of years.
Steve in Juneau. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thank you for accepting a call here. I just want to... I'm puzzled because twice the president has said before his elections that he was going to get us out of Afghanistan, and I kind of doubt that he's going to veto this pipeline. But the fact that you would suggest that Christie has a chance of being president, I mean, I hope you help him. I hope you are selected by Mr. Christie to help him become president.
And why do you think he doesn't have? What do you see as problematic with Christie, Steve?
With Christie?
Yeah, with
Christie. About three lanes for four days being blocked, and then him pointing the finger at one of his subordinates.
Do you think that issue has been settled, David, or is he still vulnerable on that?
I mean, at least at this point, and you've had a Democratic legislature sort of looking into this and investigating, and at least at this point, there's been nothing to say that he had any knowledge or direct role in that at all. Having said that, you know, Governor Christie would say this instead of me. I mean, you know, that was obviously not a good moment for his administration by any stretch of the imagination. The fact that it occurred was clearly something that was problematic. Has he gotten through that? Since people haven't made the final determination, he still has some more things to go through. I think at this point, so far, there's a general sense that it was an error that his administration made, and he's going to have to sort of consistently talk about it. But at this point, he seems to be getting through it. Unlike the gentleman who was saying, he has an interesting chance in terms of potentially in terms of the nomination, although I would suggest that there are some other challenges that he faces. But he's certainly a reasonable name in terms of given all the other candidates. Why not?
Don't you think he has to tone it down a little bit?
And now you get to, okay, so is that the reason people engage with him and like him?
Right.
Because he seems decisive and
right.
That's where he wants to go. And I think that's a call that he's going to make in terms of that's the sort of personality that he wants to be. And that's the leadership style leadership doctrine that he's going to say the country needs. And we'll see what the reaction is to it.
Mm-hmm. The caller mentioned Afghanistan, too. There is continuing debate as to whether or not we need to put boots on the ground in the Middle East or not. It just continues to be this quagmire, doesn't it? And some are saying over the weekend that ISIS is just going to be around for a long time, and it's going to be a long, long battle. Is there a clear distinction between the parties, or is it all over the place, dissension among Democrats, dissension among Republicans as to what our best case forward is?
This is one where I think you've seen party affiliation sort of fall to the background here as people really try to think through the complexity of the situation. I mean, what ISIS is doing is so horrific,
mm-hmm.
And so awful. I think there's a natural compelling of by individuals that they would like to do something, engage at a level that could really make a difference, obviously. But the point that you're making is, but then do we find ourselves back in this quagmire? And I think what you're watching is the process of what is the consensus in terms of the direction of the country, in terms of what they want to see. Because, again, this is a country that's war-weary. But having said that, when you see Americans being beheaded, suddenly you can change people's opinions in terms of what policies might have seemed unreasonable 3-6 months ago might suddenly seem like they should be discussed and on the table. So I think what you're watching is the country thinking through, going to your point, is this a quagmire or is this something that we really need to get out in front of and address?
We welcome more phone calls. David Winston is our guest for All Things Political today. He's president of the Winston Group. It's a D.C. strategic planning survey research firm. David was the director of planning for Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. He is an election analyst for CBS News and has been a strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership for the past 10 years. We'll be welcoming more phone calls for him. We've talked about a number of issues. The president about to take executive action on immigration. What do you think about that? Is that something that he should do? Or would you agree with Charles Krauthammer that his plans for immigration are impeachable? The climate change agreement reached with China, we've talked about that. Ferguson, as the verdict will come in sometime during this week, how we deal with racial tension in this country right now. Possibility of Republican contenders and analysis, again, the election wasn't that long ago, of the overwhelming Republican victory. To what do we attribute that victory, and how do Republicans govern going forward, and who do they select as a candidate most likely to capture American votes in 2016? Lines are open for you right now. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls for David Winston for All Things Political. Reed in Clintonville. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to take Mr. Winston to task for something that he said early on in the program, and that was that Mr. McConnell and Mr. Boehner suggested that the president would be poisoning the waters if he moved ahead with anything be it immigration or anything else for that matter. And yet, early on in the president's, when shortly after the president took office, Mr. McConnell poisoned the waters for all 8 years of our president's tenure by saying that they intended to make him a one-term president. They intended to do everything that they could to destroy his presidency. It smacked of racism. It smacked of hatred of the middle class and those that and lower classes that supported the president. And if that wasn't poisoning the waters and the well, I certainly don't know what was.
David.
Well, I, first off, I'm obviously going to dispute the racism and dislike of the middle class. I think that's not a, a reflection of what Senator McConnell was saying. Having said that, the fact that the idea that that was the entire focus, my guess is if you talk to him, he would like to have that particular line back because it was not something that ended up being, as the caller said, particularly constructive. And so from that perspective, but I don't think you ever heard that from Speaker Boehner, certainly in terms of wanting to work with him. In fact, right after the president was elected, again, getting folks from the Hill together with the president as they were sort of working with the stimulus package, although clearly we disagreed with at a policy level in terms of where the president was going. But nonetheless, there was a discussion that was occurring that where the president pretty much asserted he won and therefore that's the direction he was going to go. I don't think that helped either. Having said that, at this point in time, there's been an election, and clearly, as the president said, his policies were on the ballot. And so you assume as you go through that list, given what just occurred, that if you take that to its natural extension, the American electorate, who showed up, nonetheless, was pretty decisive in terms of what it said, where it wanted to go. And I would suggest that what it's looking for is a reset. And what I mean by that is that at this point in time, again, going back to this concept of they want wins on the board, sit down and work through things. Well, the president, by taking that particular action, is saying, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to just decide after losing an election at this scale to just do what I was going to do anyway. And that is not a way to sort of get everybody working together. And again, the president's got his own dynamic, at least in terms of particularly around the immigration executive order, where he said very clearly early on in his administration that he didn't think he had that legal authority. And so you've got that dynamic as well in terms of you can literally have him arguing with himself. And so at this point in time, I think it's one of those things everybody needs to take a step back and think through what's doable, not what political points am I going to try to put on the board. And that's for both sides. That goes for Republicans as well.
Thanks for the call. Brad sent a message from Minnesota. Let me just shorten this a bit. From your perspective, David, could you please compare and contrast with other presidents? What made President Obama a two-term president? Was it strategy? Was it race? What was it?
Well, first off, he came in a situation. I mean, if you think the right track, wrong track's bad now, 31-65, the day he walked in the door, and this had nothing to do with him, this is the financial crisis, the right track, wrong track from the exit poll was 21-74.
Wow.
That's just right. So the one thing is there and people were genuinely excited in terms of, hope and change in terms of that as a direction. In terms of his reelect, the Republicans decided just to make it simply a referendum on the president as opposed to saying here's some contrasting ideas. Mm-hmm. And where the electorate was at that point was, okay, we kind of agree that maybe we're not completely satisfied with how this president has performed, but you're not offering anything. And so that's not good enough. And so ultimately it wasn't. And the president got reelected. And he was saying, here's what I've done. You can agree or disagree with it. And Republicans weren't challenging him in terms of saying, here's some contrasting ideas.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to John next in Searing, Wisconsin. Hi, John.
Well, hi.
Hi.
I just want to have a comment from back a little ways in the program there. Mm-hmm. on the TV advertising or all advertising that money really doesn't speak too heavily with that because people just get tired of the ads. But I, it seems over the years, I'm fairly old, I've observed that if you say something, whether it's true, half-truth, or not true at all, if you keep repeating it and you keep emphasizing it and you say it over and over and over again, people start believing it. And I believe that's where that big money pays off that.
David?
Well, again, if you've heard that, and let me just use the, you know, that candidate, that Senator X voted for the health care plan and was the deciding vote, and you've heard that ad 74 times, right? I doubt hearing it another 5 or 6 times if, and you still have decided that you want to vote for that person. Okay, and I'm not, I don't think hearing it 10 more times is going to change your mind at that point. I think at one level, it is, you know, when people, when you introduce a new fact, that can move people, but, just repeating the same thing over and over again, it's not like you're going to change anybody's mind. And I think, but the other dynamic too here, at least in terms of the nature of the conversation, was that it was so negative that there was nothing that people could vote. There, in a lot of cases, there were not situations where people could vote for things. And I would suggest that where you saw unusual situations occur for the Republicans was where you had candidates who, in fact, did that. Cory Gardner in Colorado, Ernst in Iowa. Being two good examples of candidates who are really trying to define a direction. The other challenge here, too, is again, getting campaigns and getting the electorate to focus on what are the things that people are for. Having said that, because that wasn't in this last so prevalent in many of these races, mm-hmm. going to the point that you made earlier, turnout was lower
mm-hmm.
because people just simply were not engaged.
Yeah. Yeah. Without letting us in on too many trade secrets, it is no secret that the Republican strategy for success, there was a really terrific ground game in the midterm elections, at least as it has been analyzed in the state of Wisconsin, and I assume nationally as well, David. Were there certain kinds of technology that were used for the first times to make sure that the base turned out, that Republicans turned out?
I think but it wasn't just because this is going to the two-party bases generally do turn out, and even on the Democratic side, I think it happened. Where you get into is what I would call those sort of softer voters, people who are presidential Democratic year voters or presidential Republican year voters, or new individuals who are just beginning to engage and finding those and interacting with them and getting them turned out. Look, we had been behind by a pretty significant margin, and it was pretty apparent in 2012, at least in terms of being able to use data and information about voters to be able to have a better conversation, engage them. Democrats clearly had a lead. I think we have begun the process of catching up to that. But that's a tactical dynamic. Ultimately, you still have to have something to say. But clearly, those improvements helped in terms of this particular election. But again, where you're looking at, again, when you're looking at some of the margins in these races, while that helped, there was something else that occurred here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the margins were much larger than a lot of people thought they would be in many races, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, you know, take a look at Arkansas, where it was
really, yeah,
and the McConnell race as well in Kentucky. But mm-hmm. you also had some unusual outcomes. You know, Republicans winning the governorships in Massachusetts, Maryland, mm-hmm. and Illinois were certainly also a surprise as well.
Yeah. David, thank you so much for being with us. I enjoyed the hour. Thanks. David Winston, our guest. David is president of the Winston Group. It's a strategic planning and survey research firm. It's in D.C. He is an advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership, was director of planning for Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, and advises political parties, center-right political parties throughout Europe. He's an election analyst for CBS News as well. We always do all things political on Monday, in case you're hearing us for the very first time, and get a variety of perspectives on all the political issues of the week. Not that we don't discuss those issues during the week, but this hour is devoted to what it is that's being discussed during the week. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing All Things Political today, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, where the snow finally stopped. Oh, it's so cold. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and we will return.